Reynolds, Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. An estimated 400,000 people have died in the Syrian war. Another 100,000 are considered missing. Now, of the missing, some may be alive and held secretly in prisons controlled by Bashar al-Assad's regime, but most are probably dead and the bodies are often buried in unmarked mass graves. Now, with the Islamic State nearing defeat in Syria and Iraq, investigators are gaining access to more and more of these graves in territory formerly controlled by ISIS. Now, identifying the thousands of bodies these graves contain is important work. It not only gives resolution to families of those missing, but can also provide important evidence of war crimes. On this edition of Global Journalist, we're going to take a close look at the challenges of finding and identifying Syria's 100,000 missing people. Now, we're going to hear from four different guests who have approached this issue in different ways. Up first, we're joined by Sara Afshar. She's a filmmaker who produced and directed the award-winning documentary Syria's Disappeared. The film focuses on the tens of thousands of people, including 2,000 children, detained in Assad's prisons since the 2011 uprising against the government. She joins us now from New York. Sara, welcome.
Hi, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. You spent 3 years working on this documentary, which is about the Assad regime's prisons. Tell us how you first got interested in this topic.
I first got interested because in January 2014, I first saw a selection of these photographs that had been smuggled out of Syria showing corpses of people from regime prisons. The corpses were severely emaciated. They had signs of torture marks on them, and they were called the Caesar photographs. CNN published some of the photographs in 2014, so did the Guardian newspaper. When I saw the photographs, I thought, this is going to have a huge impact on the conflict in Syria. They were reminiscent of images from the concentration camps. But there was a Security Council resolution that was vetoed by Russia and China. And then nobody really seemed to be talking about this issue. And then it was at the time when ISIS started to come to the fore in the conflict. And all the focus, the media focus, the political focus, was on ISIS. And I was being asked to make films on ISIS. And of course, people should make films about ISIS. But by the autumn of 2014, I just felt that nobody was covering this topic, and that's why I started working on it.
Well, you reference these photos that do show images of torture and execution common in these prisons, and you spend a lot of time talking to people who survived them and family members of those who haven't come back. What sort of surprised you or affected you most from these conversations?
What surprised me and deeply affected me most in a way was that despite the horrific things that survivors told me, they still had such a determination and spirit, you know, to carry on seeking justice. They'd literally been through tragedy upon tragedy, and you know, we give a fraction really of what happened to them in the film. I can't tell you how horrific some of the things were that were described to me, but you know, it hadn't crushed them, and that kind of the human spirit, it massively inspired me. And I can really say that from all the people we met, and we interviewed many, many witnesses. There's three main witnesses in the film, but we interviewed many. And they really are inspirational.
Well, actually, we have a clip from the film Syria's Disappeared, in which a former prisoner in one of Assad's prisons is talking about how he and the other people he was held with tried to make a plan to just sort of communicate with the outside world. We're going to listen to that.
I told them, we have like 57 people here, and we need to write all their names with details as much as possible. So when someone of us go out, can take those names with them. So we started like looking for the tools.
They tore off pieces of their shirts, found a fragment of chicken bone to write with, and used rust and their own blood as ink.
And Sarah, if you could just tell us the rest of this man's story, as well as about sort of how difficult it was for people just to communicate that they were in prison.
Yeah. Well, that was Mansour Al-Amari speaking. And so he and his fellow prisoners did manage to write the names of the people in that cell on those. They were torn pieces of shirt, essentially. And, you know, Mansour was very lucky that he got released from that detention facility. And so he smuggled those shirt pieces out of the detention facility. And the way they were smuggled out was there was actually one of the cellmates was a tailor, and he sewed the shirt pieces into another garment that Mansour wore when he went out. So they were hidden, essentially. And then when Mansour, you know, was released, he contacted many of the families of the detainees that were in the cell with him. Because, you know, when people get detained, the families aren't told anything. Often they don't even know which detention facility their loved one has been taken to. They're not given any information, whether they're dead or alive, what's happened to them. Some people have been waiting 5 or 6 years to have any news. I mean, if you can imagine that your brother or your sister were suddenly snatched off the street by the security services, and then you hear nothing for 6 years about what's happened to them. That's the agony that families face day in, day out. And another person we interview in the film, Mariam, that's what happened to her son, and she was searching for him for 18 months.
Well, what you spent a lot of time speaking with family members of those who disappeared into these prisons, what are they hoping for now? Like, what are they looking for?
Well, first and foremost, they're looking for the release of these arbitrarily detained prisoners, you know, on all sides. Although I have to say that the vast majority of the detained are detained by the Assad regime. So, you know, there's actually a group called Families for Freedom that's a women-led organization of the mothers and the daughters and the wives of the disappeared. And they're asking for independent monitors to go into these detention facilities. President Assad says there's nothing going on in these facilities. Well, if there's nothing going on, why has no one been allowed to access the facilities? They want information for the families. So they want to know, you know, if their loved ones have died, if they're alive, where they've been buried, what's happened to their bodies. You know, they're not told, even when they find out about the death of their loved one, they're not told what's happened to the body. They don't have a grave for their loved one. And then they want freedom for the arbitrarily detained. And, you know, that's a priority, because as we're having this conversation now, there are people in these facilities being tortured, dying, and nothing is being done. It's not something that's being addressed by the Geneva peace talks. So that's another thing that the families want. They want this to be addressed at the peace talks, because, you know, how can they move forward without their loved ones being released? And of course, they want justice. As they say in the film, they want a court and they want court cases.
Well, Sarah Afshar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about the estimated 100,000 people missing in Syria. Now, this figure is in addition to the roughly 400,000 estimated to be dead since the uprising against Bashar al-Assad began 6 years ago. We just heard from documentary maker Sarah Afshar about the secret detention and killing of thousands of Syrians by Assad's government. Up next, we're going to talk about areas formerly controlled by ISIS in Syria and Iraq. For that, we're joined by Laurie Hinnant in Paris. She's an international security correspondent for the Associated Press, who published a lengthy investigation last year documenting 72 mass graves in territory controlled by ISIS. Laurie, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, first, if you could, your reporting identified these 72 mass graves in Syria and Iraq. How did you identify them and map where they were?
Well, what we did is there had been a lot of reports, particularly in the Sinjar area, where the Yazidis were being killed by the hundreds, of what was happening to all of these people.
Sorry, the Sinjar area, that's in northern Iraq, in territory formerly controlled by Kurds.
Exactly. It's interior, yes, and formerly controlled by ISIS. And there was a NGO called Yazda that had documented some of them. And there were others that were simply reported by witnesses who'd seen the bodies buried en masse near where they fell. And in other cases, closer to Mosul, we found one mass grave in particular after looking at satellite imagery near where we knew there had been a mass killing. And we worked with our partner Digital Globe to analyze the imagery and actually found it from space. You could see where the trucks had pulled up near the Badouche prison, where the ground had been disturbed and then smoothed over, and where the trucks had actually driven away.
Well, I understand that you also traveled to this region as part of the reporting. What do these graves look like on the ground when you're there?
There's very little protection for them now, as there was then. You can see the earth is disturbed. There was one mass grave in particular, actually, that was a series of five buried in one very lonely intersection near Sinjar. And it just looks like there's clods of earth that have clearly been disturbed. They're protected with really just minimal chicken wire, and the wind just whips around them. You can sometimes see bits of clothing emerge, but I think a lot of the groups have tried their best, since they can't excavate them and exhume the bodies, to at least cover the graves so that there's some respect paid for those who are buried underneath.
Well, what do the local people, the people who live near these mass graves, what do they know about whose bodies are inside them?
Well, in one case, we actually talked to people whose family, they knew their family was buried inside them. There was one really moving case of an old man. He was a village elder, and he had come down the hill to speak to us about the mass grave. And initially, he introduced himself just as a village elder. He'd heard we were there, and he started talking to us about how they wanted the bodies exhumed and how it was they needed to have peace brought to everybody who was in them. He talked to us for about 20 minutes. Before he finally broke down and said that his sons were in there. And he hadn't wanted to talk about it, but when he finally did, he just, it was like something was unleashed, and he just wanted to talk about his sons and bringing their bodies to rest.
Well, what can people in these areas where there are mass graves, what can they do about them?
Well, the complication is right now they can't do much because the bodies need to be identified. And there is, between the power struggle between the Iraqis and the Kurds and a general lack of money and political will, the graves right now are just staying where they are, largely untouched. And that's going to be a problem going forward in the future because it's a desert area, it's very dry, it's windy, and as every day passes, the evidence of the crimes underneath those graves, because they are also crime scenes, degrades, and the capacity to identify the victims also becomes harder and harder.
You talked about this Badouche prison near Mosul in northern Iraq, where I guess it was mainly Shiite inmates were executed. And their bodies were burned back in 2014. What do we know about that grave?
Well, that grave has since been directly confirmed by our team on the ground. And it was finally the area was freed. And they confirmed that there is indeed the mass grave that we had spotted from satellite imagery was what we thought it was. And thus far, it has not been exhumed. Like the others, there's, in addition to there being complications over control of territory, over political sensitivities, there is an additional problem in particular with mass graves like that, which is that there is a fear and an expectation that ISIS has booby-trapped a lot of them, particularly the most notorious ones, where it's expected that underneath the earth that has covered them, there are going to be bombs intended to detonate as soon as somebody tries to retrieve the bodies.
Well,
so they have to move very carefully.
Laurie, our time grows short, but I did want to ask you, what role is there for the United Nations, for the international community in addressing this issue?
Well, one of the main things is to help provide the money and the space and the forensics to identify the victims who are inside the mass graves. More than anything, that's what families want. They want to know what happened to their loved ones. And certainly the international community has people who have that expertise. It's just a question of giving them the ability to go to the graves and carefully exhume them with demining teams and to finally let these families have the peace that they're looking for.
Well, Lori Hinnan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about the challenges in finding and identifying the remains of the estimated 100,000 people missing in Syria. Now, if you're interested in more Global Journalist, you can visit us online at globaljournalist.org. You can read an interview with a Syrian activist who survived two detentions in Assad's prisons, including the notorious Saidnaya prison outside Damascus. You can also follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, get our podcast on iTunes, or watch the videocast of this program on YouTube. Up next, we're going to talk about some of the technical and logistical problems of identifying those buried in Syria's mass graves. For that, we're going to bring in two experts in this area. Joining us from The Hague in the Netherlands is Andreas Kleiser. He's the Director for Policy and Cooperation at the International Commission on Missing Persons. And in Washington, D.C. is Moses Schoenfield. He's a professor of forensic science at George Washington University who worked to help identify missing people buried in mass graves in Croatia after the Balkan Wars of the 1990s. Welcome to both of you. Let me start with you, Moses Schoenfield. Tell us just generally, what is the process of exhuming and identifying bodies in mass graves?
Well, the first problem is finding the graves. In your case, you've identified some 70-odd graves. One of the concerns we had in the Balkans, or at least in Croatia, was we had been told that some of the graves had grenades, mines, other things in them. So we were a little cautious in the initial excavation of graves. So the graves have to be excavated. The next process is identification of the remains. They're all autopsied to identify wounds, possible sources of how they died. In Croatia, we used a mixture of personal effects and DNA typing. So you have to have a DNA lab. While we were working in Croatia, teams from the ICMP were in Herzegovina or Bosnia and in Serbia. So it requires a huge lab effort. When you're talking about the number of people in Syria and Iraq, you're talking about an enormous effort and obviously a very expensive effort.
Well, let me turn this to Andreas Kleiser then. And Andreas, first of all, you work for the International Commission on Missing Persons. Tell us just a bit about how your organization goes about generally helping to find missing people after wars, after conflicts.
Yes, thank you. The International Commission on Missing Persons, ICMP in short, is an intergovernmental mechanism established by governments to assist governments in their efforts to locate the missing. It is an organization that is based on a rule of law and human rights approach. And as we've heard, it has been working in the Balkans, that was just mentioned, which is also a good example for the normal working mechanism, which consists of securing the cooperation of governments concerned and confronting a missing persons scenario and assisting them to carry out the work of investigating what happened to the missing.
And when you say missing, is it the case that in most cases, if someone is a missing person, that they are dead after a conflict? How often is it that people turn out to be alive?
The majority of persons missing and or that remain missing for a significant period of time must be presumed dead. In many cases, investigations will already have revealed the existence of mass graves. The victims in mass graves clearly are are missing persons from the perspective of their relatives. So that will then require technical processes, and some have been mentioned already, such as DNA analysis and other means to conduct human identification. But as I said earlier, the work is the primary responsibility of governments and of law enforcement and of prosecutors and courts, legal systems. So we also need to have legal instruments in place that permit investigating crimes. And usually this involves crimes, as would be done in a rule of law framework.
Well, so, if I could just turn this to Moses Schonfield, then we heard Andreas Kleiser talking about the forensics process of excavating mass graves for not only to find remains for family members, but to document evidence of crimes. Tell us how that process has changed, might be different now for what investigators are going to try to do in Syria and Iraq than it was a couple decades ago in the Balkans.
A couple decades ago, we did not have the luxury of satellite imagery where we could find mass graves. We relied heavily on prisoners being exchanged to tell us where the graves were. So it's a multi-stage process. The biggest thing is finding the graves. One of the points that was made is the fact that you have to have the cooperation of government. When we were in Croatia, the war was still on. We had military police with weapons in case combatants showed up. We were fortunate that didn't happen. So one of the biggest differences, I think, between Syria and Iraq is there's still active conflict and you're not sure what's going on. And so you do not have a rule of law. You do not have criminal investigations going on. So there are many issues here that make it much more difficult for people like the ICMP or anybody to come in there. And in the Balkans, labs were set up in these various areas, the various constituents. So we had two labs in Croatia. There's a lab in Sarajevo. I think there's two other labs as well. So there's multiple labs working.
Well, Andreas, you heard Moses Schonfield talking about the importance of the cooperation of local governments. Obviously, that's not the case in Syria. Many of the mass graves are in areas controlled by the Assad regime. The Assad regime is thought, in many cases, to have killed the people who are in the mass graves and have no interest in having them investigated. So where does that leave sort of this process of trying to identify people and searching for them?
Well, as was just noted, Moses, that in a live conflict, it is, of course, very difficult, if not impossible, to institute a consistent process of investigating missing persons cases. Once the fighting has ceased, there is a need to reinstate the rule of law. There's a need to reinstate institutions that can administer the rule of law, and efforts on their part to locate the missing go usually a long way to creating trust in the population in such institutions, which in turn then enhances their credibility. So there's a larger context to efforts to locate the missing. It is rebuilding confidence in public authority and making the institutions more trustworthy. Now, in the situation in Syria, obviously, we have an ongoing conflict. However, we do not have an ongoing conflict everywhere where we have missing Syrians. We have many Syrian refugees, many of whom have gone missing, trying to cross the Mediterranean, for instance, that you have family members in Europe. European states, in that case, have an obligation to investigate the fate of missing family members. So we're quite able to secure the cooperation of governments, work with rule of law mechanisms where Syrians are, for instance, in Europe and where we do not have a live conflict. As regards to the Syrians missing inside Syria, we are at this time implementing a regional program that collects information, eventually even genetic reference data from Syrian refugees and families in surrounding countries. So that is in Iraq, in Jordan, in Turkey, and in Lebanon, which will, we hope, bring us in a position to very rapidly assist Syria in instituting effective missing persons processes through Syrian institutions once the fighting has come to an end. So there's a lot that can be done, and that's where we stand.
Well, Moses, if I could ask you, again, just in comparing the scope of this work with that in the former Yugoslavia, I think there was something like 40,000 missing people in Yugoslavia. And the ICMP and other organizations have been working for a long time and have identified the majority of those. But in Syria, we're talking about 100,000 people, and basically no one can be on the ground in the conflict areas. So is it even sort of feasible to talk about identifying the remains of these people, or have they just sort of vanished from the earth?
It's feasible, but not going to be something that's quickly done. The major problems are, as Andreas implied, is one, finding out who's missing, and two, collecting reference samples from their blood relatives so that if graves are identified and can be exhumed, that they can then test those people. But it's not a rapid process. It's not going to be, it's going to be an expensive process. DNA technology has gotten better. We've gone to the best technology we can now. So all of those things are going to have a factor.
Well, Andreas, our time grows short, but I just wanted to ask you, what do you foresee happening on this issue over the next year or two?
Specifically in Syria, I do foresee building confidence with the refugee population in surrounding countries, being able to collect information on missing persons, being able to prepare a future strategy for locating missing Syrians, and to garner support in Europe to build an encompassing approach that is not just limited to one particular jurisdiction.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Our thanks to Sarah Afshar, Lori Hinnant, Andreas Kleiser, and Moses Schanfield for joining us. Global Journalist Assistant Producers this week are Astriga Gopian, Jamie Dunaway, and Sierra Morris, with supervising producer Lauren Workman. Elisa Blyle is visual editor, Aaron Hay is audio engineer, Travis McMillan is director, and so for all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.